Now, the passage of the health care law counted as a political earthquake, though we're still learning how it affects Americans. One part of this law seems straightforward. It involves the Medicaid health program for the poor, and the new law opens that program to millions of people who do not have insurance right now. What is not yet clear is whether getting people into Medicaid will actually get them in to see a doctor. NPR's Julie Rodden reports on the effort to make the law work.
Back in February, at President Obama's bipartisan Blair House health meeting, Iowa Republican Senator Charles Grassley pointed out a dirty little secret about the health bill's plan to add millions of people to the Medicaid rolls.
Medicaid pays about, in my state, I think about 60-some percent. Medicare pays 80% of costs. Doctors don't take Medicaid. So you're going to promise 14 to 18 million people in Medicaid that they're going to be covered? But if you don't have doctors to service them, isn't that a little bit intellectually dishonest to promise something that you can't deliver on?
Stephen Zuckerman, a health economist at the Urban Institute, says it's not just Iowa where Medicaid underpays. It's a problem in lots of states.
There are fewer Medicaid enrollees that get access to mainstream physicians, in large part because physicians can choose who they want to treat, and with Medicaid fees sort of at the bottom of the barrel, physicians are less likely to take patients with that coverage.
So the budget bill the president signed last week, which included fixes to the health bill, included something to address that Medicaid payment problem. It requires that primary care doctors who treat Medicaid patients be paid at least as much as they would be if they were treating Medicare patients. And the federal government, not the states, will pay the difference in rates. Zuckerman says he doesn't expect the difference to be dramatic, but he does expect it to be noticeable.
I think what you're going to see as reimbursements are increased for primary care physicians, that there probably will be some primary care physicians that previously would not have considered taking Medicaid patients who will now say, all right, well, these patients are probably, you know, worth treating.
In many cases, however, it's more than just low rates that keep doctors from accepting Medicaid patients. Some doctors say Medicaid patients don't keep appointments, or they don't follow doctors' orders or take their medications like they should. And in some cases, says Zuckerman, it's not about the patients at all. It's about the bureaucracy.
The program is, you know, not the easiest to deal with. There are a lot of delays in payment. There's difficulties in getting certified in some states as a Medicaid provider who can actually bill the program. I mean, there are a lot of administrative hassles.
But both Zuckerman and Peter Cunningham, a researcher at the Center for Studying Health System Change, say boosting primary care payments may not be the most important fix for Medicaid. Finding primary care has never been the biggest problem for Medicaid patients, Cunningham says.
Because a lot of people on Medicaid get their care at community health centers or federally qualified health centers, and they are also going to be expanding.
Community health center funding is going up by $11 billion under the new law, effectively doubling that program's funding. Rather, says Cunningham,
where there tends to be the biggest access problems for Medicaid is often with the specialty care, and their rates are not going to be increased, at least by the health reform.
That means for the foreseeable future, says Zuckerman.
You still may have a lot of Medicaid beneficiaries who are dependent on specialists that are working in public hospitals or other nonprofit hospitals that tend to have a greater commitment to dealing with low-income populations.
Which will be fine in the urban areas where there are lots of those kinds of facilities. But in smaller cities and rural areas, there may be lots of new Medicaid patients who can find primary care, but no one to care for them when they get really sick. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
The Easter Bunny has come and gone for most children, but there is still one more place it needs to visit, the White House. Tomorrow, as many as 30,000 families will descend on the South Lawn to search out 13,000 dyed eggs. The Easter tradition started on the Capitol lawn in the early 1800s, but Congress outlawed that egg roll because the grass took such a beating with all those kids around. So the event moved to the White House in 1878. The egg roll was put on hold during the First and Second World Wars and during the Truman administration. Apparently, both the eggs and the buck stopped with President Truman. If all this leaves you hungry for more facts about eggs, we can oblige. My colleague Scott Simon, host of Weekend Edition Saturday, is here on a Sunday to help me out. Scott, hi.
Hi there. Nice to be here.
So, let's get rolling.
Easter egg rolling. Okay. By the way, I'm not sure I believe any of this, but scientists believe that chickens settled in the New World 100 years before Europeans. They were Polynesian chickens. They traveled with their owners by canoe, so the New World's first chicken egg presumably appeared shortly thereafter.
Today, 6.4 billion edible incredible eggs are produced in the United States each month by around 280 million hens. That's not enough hens.
I think we can figure out what goes on there. And one-third of those eggs are cracked open and processed for commercial use.
It takes 24 to 26 hours for a hen to produce one egg.
The heaviest chicken eggs can weigh up to half a pound. Though New Jersey folklore has it, I don't know why we're quoting folklore, particularly from New Jersey, has it that the biggest egg ever laid was in 1956, weighed 1 pound, and it is said to have had two yolks and two layers of shell.
The average eggshell has 17,000 pores on its surface.
Refrigerated eggs can stay fresh for 45 days after their pack date, and it's still all right to eat them after that. They will maintain their nutritional value, but they might not taste very good after 45 days.
A large chicken egg contains about 70 calories, 6 grams of protein, 5 grams of fat, and 213 milligrams of cholesterol. The American Heart Association recommends no more than 300 milligrams of cholesterol a day.
The greatest height from which an egg has been dropped without breaking is 700 feet. And the man who did it dropped the egg from a helicopter onto a golf course in Blackpool, England. Why?
Yeah, exactly.
Of all the things to be doing on a golf course.
If you drop an egg on the floor while making a cake, it will be easier to clean up if you sprinkle it heavily with salt first.
Eggs can bind meatloaf, they can leaven sponge cake, thicken a sauce, emulsify mayonnaise, glaze bread, garnish a plate.
And amuse a child. The Garrison Egg Hunt in Homer, Georgia, holds the record for the largest hard-boiled egg hunt, 72,000 eggs.
And there's something, this just in, Linda.
Yeah.
Yes, this weekend, Steve Jobs is going to announce the creation of the iEgg. And it, now wait, there's no yolk, and you can't use it as a phone, but it does have a full-color display and you can surf the web.
The Easter Bunny has come and gone for most children, but there is still one more place it needs to visit, the White House. Tomorrow, as many as 30,000 families will descend on the South Lawn to search out 13,000 dyed eggs. The Easter tradition started on the Capitol lawn in the early 1800s, but Congress outlawed that egg roll because the grass took such a beating with all those kids around. So the event moved to the White House in 1878. The egg roll was put on hold during the First and Second World Wars and during the Truman administration. Apparently, both the eggs and the buck stopped with President Truman. If all this leaves you hungry for more facts about eggs, we can oblige. My colleague Scott Simon, host of Weekend Edition Saturday, is here on a Sunday to help me out. Scott, hi.
Hi there. Nice to be here.
So, let's get rolling.
Easter egg rolling. Okay. By the way, I'm not sure I believe any of this, but scientists believe that chickens settled in the New World 100 years before Europeans. They were Polynesian chickens. They traveled with their owners by canoe. So the New World's first chicken egg presumably appeared shortly thereafter.
Today, 6.4 billion edible incredible eggs are produced in the United States each month by around 280 million hens. That's not enough hens.
I think we can I think we can figure out what goes on there. And one third of those eggs are cracked open and processed for commercial use.
It takes 24 to 26 hours for a hen to produce one egg.
The heaviest chicken eggs can weigh up to half a pound. Though New Jersey folklore has it, I don't know why we're quoting folklore, particularly from New Jersey, has it that the biggest egg ever laid was in 1956, weighed 1 pound, and it is said to have had two yolks and two layers of shell.
The average eggshell has 17,000 pores on its surface.
Refrigerated eggs can stay fresh for 45 days after their pack date, and it's still all right to eat them after that. They will maintain their nutritional value, but they might not taste very good after 45 days.
A large chicken egg contains about 70 calories, 6 grams of protein, 5 grams of fat, and 213 milligrams of cholesterol. The American Heart Association recommends no more than 300 milligrams of cholesterol a day.
The greatest height from which an egg has been dropped without breaking is 700 feet. And the man who did it dropped the egg from a helicopter onto a golf course in Blackpool, England. Why?
Exactly.
Of all the things to be doing on a golf course.
If you drop an egg on the floor while making a cake, it will be easier to clean up if you sprinkle it heavily with salt first.
Eggs can bind meatloaf, they can leaven sponge cake, thicken a sauce, emulsify mayonnaise, glaze bread, garnish a plate.
And amuse a child. The Garrison Egg Hunt in Homer, Georgia, holds the record for the largest hard-boiled egg hunt, 72,000 eggs.
And there's something, this just in, Linda.
Yeah?
Yes, this weekend, Steve Jobs is going to announce the creation of the iEgg. Wait, there's no yolk, and you can't use it as a phone, but it does have a full-color display, and you can surf the web.
The Easter Bunny has come and gone for most children, but there is still one more place it needs to visit, the White House. Tomorrow, as many as 30,000 families will descend on the South Lawn to search out 13,000 dyed eggs. The Easter tradition started on the Capitol lawn in the early 1800s, but Congress outlawed that egg roll because the grass took such a beating with all those kids around. So the event moved to the White House in 1878. The egg roll was put on hold during the First and Second World Wars and during the Truman administration. Apparently, both the eggs and the buck stopped with President Truman. If all this leaves you hungry for more facts about eggs, we can oblige. My colleague Scott Simon, host of Weekend Edition Saturday, is here on a Sunday to help me out. Scott, hi.
Hi there. Nice to be here.
So, let's get rolling.
Easter egg rolling. Okay. By the way, I'm not sure I believe any of this, but scientists believe that chickens settled in the New World 100 years before Europeans. They were Polynesian chickens. They traveled with their owners by canoe. So the New World's first chicken egg presumably appeared shortly thereafter.
Today, 6.4 billion edible incredible eggs are produced in the United States each month by around 280 million hens. That's not enough hens.
I think we can I think we can figure out what goes on there. And one third of those eggs are cracked open and processed for commercial use.
It takes 24 to 26 hours for a hen to produce one egg.
The heaviest chicken eggs can weigh up to half a pound. Though New Jersey folklore has it, I don't know why we're quoting folklore, particularly from New Jersey, has it that the biggest egg ever laid was in 1956, weighed 1 pound, and it is said to have had two yolks and two layers of shell.
The average eggshell has 17,000 pores on its surface.
Refrigerated eggs can stay fresh for 45 days after their pack date, and it's still all right to eat them after that. They will maintain their nutritional value, but they might not taste very good after 45 days.
A large chicken egg contains about 70 calories, 6 grams of protein, 5 grams of fat, and 213 milligrams of cholesterol. The American Heart Association recommends no more than 300 milligrams of cholesterol a day.
The greatest height from which an egg has been dropped without breaking is 700 feet. And the man who did it dropped the egg from a helicopter onto a golf course in Blackpool, England. Why?
Exactly.
Of all the things to be doing on a golf course.
If you drop an egg on the floor while making a cake, it will be easier to clean up if you sprinkle it heavily with salt first.
Eggs can bind meatloaf, they can leaven sponge cake, thicken a sauce, emulsify mayonnaise, glaze bread, garnish a plate.
And amuse a child. The Garrison Egg Hunt in Homer, Georgia, holds the record for the largest hard-boiled egg hunt, 72,000 eggs.
And there's something, this just in, Linda.
Yeah.
Yes, this weekend, Steve Jobs is going to announce the creation of the iEgg. And it, now wait, there's no yolk, and you can't use it as a phone, but it does have a full-color display, and you can surf the web.
Some people may be using high-tech surveillance technology to get their hands on a book. Adults cannot wait to read The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest, the final installment in Stieg Larsson's trilogy. But in this country, they're not lining up at the local bookstore. They are ordering their copies from overseas, where the book has already been released. NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
Stieg Larsson's Millennium Trilogy is a genuine publishing phenomenon. More than 3.5 million copies of the first two books are in print in the U.S. alone. A film version of the first book, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, has just been released. And the U.S. release of the third book is scheduled for the end of May. Paul Bogards, executive director of publicity for Knopp, the U.S. publisher, says no one knew how big the books would be.
We thought that Stieg Larsson, as an author, should be a best-selling author. But did we see the juggernaut on the horizon, the international juggernaut that Stieg Larsson has become? No.
Knopf obtained the rights to Stieg Larsson's books after his death. He was an unknown in the U.S., so the publishing company's first priority was to introduce him to the public. At that point, they didn't think about the need for a simultaneous release of the books in different countries. They just wanted time to build interest with the release of each book. They had no idea that avid fans like John Gompertz would be so eager to get their hands on The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest.
Well, once you know you can have it, once you know it exists in English and you can buy it, it would be crazy not to.
Gompertz didn't waste any time after a friend told him the book would be available in Britain long before the U.S. release in May.
She said, well, you know, you can just go on Amazon.uk and buy it. And in fact, she said, I've already been there. It's coming out on October 8th. As it turned out, it was released on October 1st. I had it and I had read it by October 8th.
Celeste Warrington of Cincinnati says there's one really good reason why she wanted to get the book sooner rather than later.
Impatience.
Warrington had already read the first book in English when she discovered her husband had bought the second book during a trip to France. It was part of a pile of books he'd gotten to help him with his French, and Warrington instantly realized he didn't know what a treasure he had.
So I called him. I said, can I take this book? You read the first one in English. I would like to read this one. And I did and loved it. He read the first and second and loved it. So that we couldn't wait. We jumped the gun and went on Amazon.fr and ordered the third one. And we ordered two copies because we realized we weren't going to be able to share.
And you ordered it in French.
Yeah, which was terrific. It was great. It was really fun.
All this online book buying did not escape the attention of booksellers like David Thompson of Murder by the Book Mystery Bookstore in Houston. Thompson says the store wanted to honor the U.S. release date, but it kept getting harder and harder.
We'd gotten several very loyal customers who just absolutely needed the third book because the second one ends with such a cliffhanger. You really, really want to read that third one right away. And so we felt that it was really important to serve our customers and import these books that there was a desperate demand for.
Eventually, Knopf found out that Thompson's store and others were importing copies of The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest and selling them to their customers. Knopf asked the booksellers to stop the practice, which they did because, says Paul Bogards,
because it's against the law. It's a violation of copyright law.
Online booksellers are also supposed to honor the U.S. release date, which Bogards says consumers may not know.
What I would say to readers is I would encourage them to shop at their their local bookseller here in the United States or their local online bookseller here in the United States, where no laws are being broken and you're supporting the continuing discovery of world literature.
As for the future, there's lots of talk of a possible fourth book. And if that happens, Bogard says...
Let me say this. If there is a fourth book, and we know that there are 200 pages of a fourth book somewhere, I can assure you that we will consider, if we ever have the opportunity to publish it, we will consider publishing it simultaneously with our UK partner.
Fans like John Gompertz would love another book, but having already read the third one, Gompertz says the last 100 pages of it were so satisfying, he doesn't mind stopping right there. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Now we open up the pages of the Washington Post magazine, which we do just about every week to find interesting stories about the way we live now. This weekend, the magazine took on the conflict many mothers have been having for decades to work outside the home or stay home with the kids. For many women, the decision is made for them. They just can't afford to stop working. But many other women have the choice, but the decision is agonizing. Let somebody else watch those first steps, celebrate the first tooth? No way. But then usually it changes, and at some point the decision is made to go back out to work. In this economy, many stay-at-home mothers are making that decision as the men in their lives lose their jobs or see their hours cut. And the choice to go back to work can be just as hard as leaving to begin with. Freelance writer Catherine Reynolds Lewis followed one mom back to work. That mom is Amy Beckett, a mom of three, who after 17 years decided to return to her career as a lawyer. She's the subject of Lewis's story, The Return, and they're both here with us now in our Washington, D.C. studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Catherine, how did you get on to this story?
As a mom myself, I struggled with the issue of, will I go back to work after maternity leave? How much will I go back? And I always wondered about that path I didn't take. And especially with this economy, I figured if any time was going to be impossible for a stay-at-home mom to return to work, it would be now. And I wanted to take an in-depth look at the specific challenges and struggles that she would face.
And one of the challenges is, as we understand it, and older workers, I mean, I'm going to use that term gently, are less likely to be unemployed. But when they are unemployed, it takes them much longer to get back into the labor force. So is part of the challenge here the age of the person involved, or is it just the long break in service from paid employment?
It's both. One of the things that workers in their, you know, late 40s, 50s face is the perception that they want to come back at a certain salary level, they want to come back at a certain type of job, and that can be almost insurmountable for many people, not only in their own heads, but also when they're trying to explain the situation to an employer.
And as you point out in your piece, this is not uncommon. About a third of married mothers leave the labor force to care for their children in any given year. The Census Bureau counted 5.3 million stay-at-home mothers in 2008, about 24% of all married mothers with children under 15. So, Amy, tell us, you said in the piece that you really had no intention of staying home initially as a lawyer. You had no intention. And so what happened?
Oh, yeah. Be very careful what you swear you'll never do, because it's probably a roadmap for what you'll end up following in the end. What happened was I had taken a maternity leave, and I was absolutely convinced I was going to go back when my baby was 4 months old. Started thinking about childcare for her. I took my leave, then my husband was going to take his leave. And friends of ours had a nanny who they were hoping to pass on to me. She came highly recommended. And so I invited her to our home to interview her. And she sat down on the couch next to me and picked up my baby, Nellie, at the time, and was holding her and looking at her and looking at her face. And then she turned to me and said in her sort of Jamaican accent, "So what will be my duties?" And I welled up and my voice started shaking and I said, "Oh, to love my baby."
And how was that? Oh no, this is not going to happen. So you were fortunate enough that your husband earned enough to support the family, so you quit your job. But I understand, as I take it, you really never intended to stay out, as it were, for this long, or is that
absolutely?
Was
not.
It like a year by year thing? What happened?
What happened is that in a couple more years we had a second child, and I'd stayed home with one. Staying home with two seemed equally demanding, but you know, I started kind of sniffing around and taking on little projects from time to time, and thinking that about the time that my second daughter was two would be a good time to start to look for work. I wasn't quite sure how or what. We lived in Chicago at the time. I had a lot of connections. I had a fabulous network. And I actually was starting to get a couple of offers One was to teach a labor class to union workers. I was getting feelers from a firm maybe to come part-time, but then my husband had a fabulous opportunity to work in Australia.
So there you go. So again, you're sort of the trailing spouse, and then you come back here, and the rest, as we say, is history. And you were also candid, I think, about the fact that part of the impetus for going back is the economy. Your husband's hours were less, or
well,
right?
In 2006, he lost his job, and that was a point at which I really needed to ramp things up. I had done some contract work. I had sort of thought about looking. I had gotten admitted to the DC bar, but when he lost a job, I really needed to be able to find work. And I got close, but I could never seal the deal.
And why do you think that is? Do you think it's because you are, saying this very gently, older? Which is, you're not 25. I mean, if you have, you know, three kids and, you know...
Well, a couple things.
Is it that they felt your skills weren't up to par, or what
the
do you
gap?
Think?
The gap is really sometimes insurmountable. It's really hard to overcome. And part of the benefit and value of the Lawyers Reentry Program that I later signed up for and the iRelaunch seminar was that they helped me come up with strategies to account for that gap, you know, and
wait, why should you have to account for that gap? You weren't selling dope, as I recall. I mean, on the side, I mean, so.
An assumption that your skills are stale, that you don't have a sufficient commitment to your career.
So how did you overcome it?
In a couple of ways. One way was I did start to do part-time contract work, so I got back into a new subspecialty. I'd always done sort of labor law and some employment law, and I found my way to doing that on a very part-time basis from home, not actually meeting or serving clients, but rather working for solo practice lawyers who needed help. So that was one way I actually filled in the gap a little. Number two, I absolutely had to reduce my expectations. I was looking at jobs where I thought I could go in as a lawyer with 10 to 15 years experience, and what I found is I needed to scale back. Now, that presents its own set of problems because there were employers who didn't want somebody with my experience. Now, is that a code word for age discrimination? I don't know, but I was told.
Well, they thought you'd be perpetually dissatisfied, that you would be annoyed that you were scaling back. That's interesting. Well, I don't want to, how can I put this? I don't want to give it all away, but let's just say there was a happy ending. And so people can read the piece. We'll have a link on our website so they can read the piece to see how that happy ending came about. But Catherine, I wanted to ask you, there were some low moments that you followed with Amy, some real discouraging moments, some tears, if you don't mind my saying, until we arrived at the end. What do you think the takeaway is of the piece? Obviously, Catherine had some advantages. She's highly educated, and better educated workers tend to do better no matter how long they've been out. She had the advantage of a program that specifically kind of helped her buff up her presentation, I think. But is there any other takeaway for people who are embarking on this journey?
Just that it's persistence that pays off. The majority of job seekers give up after just a couple of months of looking, and Amy was looking in earnest on an almost full-time basis for, I want to say, 8 months. And she was very, every time a hit came, she maybe had some tears, but she picked herself back up, as her husband Monty says in the piece, and she dusted herself off. And just to have that inner resolve and persistence and the support of her family and her colleagues from the training programs, I think that's really invaluable, to have people that you check in with who are going to ask you, what have you done on your job search, and have you rewritten your resume? And the other takeaway is you have to sell yourself. Nobody is going to do it for you. You have to come up with a good story to explain the valuable things that you did do when you were home with your kids. And if you can, if you're thinking strategically, when you're home, keep connected to your workplace or your colleagues and keep those networks alive. In Amy's case, she moved from Chicago to Washington, so it was a little harder.
So keep hope alive. Okay. All right. Amy Beckett is a mother of three I'll give it away. She recently returned to her law career after a 17-year break to raise her children. Catherine Reynolds Lewis is a freelance writer. She wrote about Beckett and her search for work in this week's Washington Post magazine. Her story is The Return, and we'll have a link on our site if you'd like to read it for yourself. Ladies, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.